All right, Max and Steve, you are the media. Well, you don't sound excited to be the media. Yeah. I want to hear you laughing. I want to see smiling faces.
I'm retweeting.
Because you're the media.
Stuff. Yeah, that's the way you're the media.
You're the megaphone.
Telling me that he gets a notice every time we start our very serious Bitcoin show. He's like, whoa, we're talking about serious Bitcoin topics.
How does he get a notice?
Right. I think it's just, you know, when we go live, it goes.
I'm focused now. Let's go.
You're focused. I mean, this is basically going to be, you know, the Steve custody show, which in the past, whenever Steve has talked about custody, people have, you know, kind of been very hyper-focused and tuning in and always wanting more. So I think we've got a good topic. We've also been going in our chat, we're talking about this Coinbase lending thing that was just announced yesterday. So I think we'd like to reserve some time to talk about that and understand it a bit better. And I think there's a bunch of trade-offs and, you know, obviously we've all been sort of active with Lava and want to try to understand what are the differences between what Coinbase is doing and what Lava and other solutions bring to the lending side of things.
But then if we get to it, I have two fascinating threads from Stacker News around dead internet theory versus the Lightning Network and bootstrapping a parallel economy, selling resources and services on Nostra, which I think are quite fascinating. So hopefully we'll get to touch on those. And if not, we'll dive deeper, but there's a lot happening.
All right. We'll try to save some time for that. So let's kick it off with this. I mean, we've been teasing this custody survey results for several weeks now, and, you know, not for any reason other than it was sort of, I think, incomplete at that time. But I think it was originally Steve had some motivation around why to do this, then executed a whole process. So I'm going to actually just turn it over to Steve. Can you tell us what was sort of the instigation or kind of inspiration for this project, and then what's it all about?
Sure. And just a reminder to those listening, we love audience engagement. So please feel free to reach out to us and in the live chat, especially if you have questions or disagree with any of the statements we're making about custody. It's a charged topic because it's such an important topic. So
feel free to roast.
What's my motivation? Also, it's not the Steve topic. But both of you guys are really passionate about this topic. Most Bitcoiners are. In this survey that I did was with, like, you know, 8 or 9 people, including you guys. So hopefully what I say is, you know, representative of quite a few views. But yeah, I mean, what's the inspiration? Why is this important? I don't think we have to spend too much time on, like, why custody of Bitcoin is important. Bitcoin's valuable. If you have Bitcoin, you don't want to lose it. So you have to answer the question, how do you custody it? Even if you buy it somewhere and just leave it there, you are making a decision. That's your custody. So if you buy it on Cash App or Coinbase or River, do you just leave it there? A lot of people do. But there might be reasons to move it off. And if you do, where do you put it? BitKey is a product that I talk quite a bit about and champion. I champion it more because I really like the what I would call revolutionary design aspects to it. I think it really levels up the ability to self-custody for normal people. So I'm really excited about that. I hope to see that in many more products throughout the space. It's similar, like we talked about AnchorWatch last week, and I'm not affiliated with AnchorWatch in any way, but I really liked AnchorWatch as well because it also is it's a novel approach to custody, and I think it's a unique offering in the space. So I just love to see companies, projects, products leveling custody up. So in any case, you know, what's this survey that we're talking about? Out of my, you know, set of like friends and peers who I talk about custody a lot with, there's different views on various products. Recently, I ping folks, I just message folks I respect and ask them about their take on BitKey. Would they use it? Would they recommend it? And I get mixed results. Some are as excited about it as me. Others are more skeptical or concerned about it. So I created the survey just to better understand that. The survey looks at 4 categories of custody products. There could certainly be more. In fact, we found some gaps, you know, as people were completing it. But the 4 I chose and I stuck with just to get consistent results. 1 is like third party, like exchanges, custodians, and I guess you could bundle ETFs in there as well. Although later, I think if I did this again, I'd maybe split ETFs out separately. But for the survey, it was not. basically the entire bundle of third parties is one category. Another category, what I call just hardware wallets, but really this self-custody products on the market today, where the customer user just uses it sort of as directed. They don't spend any more time researching OPSEC and like how to really be diligent about protecting their Bitcoin. They basically just use the product as instructed. That could be a Trezor, a Ledger, a Cold Card. It could also be a mobile wallet. It could be any kind of self-custody product. But I think primarily the people who completed the survey had in mind a Cold Card, Trezor, Ledger type of product. The third category is the same as the second, except the person put a substantial amount of time into researching and educating themselves on OPSEC. And I defined it as 100 plus hours, because in my experience, that's actually what I think it takes. You know, everyone that completed the survey and people are listening, I mean, we can debate, you know, is it really, you know, 50 hours or 70 hours, 100 or 200? I don't think that really matters, actually, whether it's 50 or 200. The point is, it's a large amount of time, and you have to be pretty committed to put that time into it. It's my contention that most people today don't have the time, patience, ability, willingness to put in that time. I've also
just to shorthand the difference between put in the time versus not put in the time with the hardware wallet. The way I think about it is, are you basically using it out of the box the way the vendor of the hardware wallet kind of suggests, which is often with their own transaction coordinator on like your Mac or PC or something, versus the 100 hours more like you're using Electrum or Sparrow or one of the kind of more open source things, maybe on Tails OS or something like that. So just to kind of distinguish between what's the typical characteristic of 100 plus hour, whatever the number is, study, it's more like not using it necessarily out of the box, but using it with a little bit more kind of custom software stack.
Yeah. Thanks for that, David. Another example would be that all the products in this both second and third category that I'm mentioning give the customer direct access to private key material, typically in the form of a seed phrase, 12 or 24 words, which are, you know, English words that are simple and familiar. But it's like foot guns waiting to happen because a user falls into one of two camps. They either understand and appreciate how sensitive that is, or they don't. And if they don't, they're likely to mishandle it and not understand they can have their entire life savings taken from them and as fast as like someone just taking a photo of those words. For those who do appreciate and understand how sensitive that data is, they're, you know, that's where they can go down a really, you know, negative mental cycle trying to figure out how to protect themselves against the myriad of security issues, attack vectors, etc. And that's where you need to put in substantial amount of time to really understand that, to protect yourself against all those risks. The fourth category was BitKey, and you know, BitKey, the specific product, but really, you know, more generally just that design, that particular design, because BitKey's design is notable in that it doesn't give customers direct access to private key material. So I think people who filled out the survey did concretely were evaluating BitKey, the product, because that's the only example of that type of product on the market today. But over time, I'd expect that to be a general category and not just one specific product. So that was like the four categories. And then that was, it was a matrix with the other axis being six different attack vector categories. And again, this, you know, people can nitpick this and say we forgot the seventh and eighth one and things like that, but I had to draw a line somewhere. So the six attack vectors, one was phishing attacks, two was company risk, three government risk, four malware, five backups loss, and six was key generation.
Is this something, can we actually share the template, or because I feel like a screen share here might be helpful.
Yeah. Do you have the template? If not, I can send it to you, or I can.
I don't have it handy right here. If you've got a link to it, I can.
Yep. There you go. I just messaged it to you.
Okay. So I will open this up. Hopefully, I don't need to be logged in or something. All right. Can you see that now?
Yeah. Thanks for showing that. So You can see in the at the top of the spreadsheet, the in columns B through E, that's the four categories I just mentioned. And then rows 2 through 7 are the 6 attack vector categories.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, towards the bottom of the spreadsheet, there's a key which, you know, defines or gives examples of what is meant by each of these. And then the only other thing that we've not spoken to yet is just like, what are you to fill in these blanks? And that's identifying what risk you believe each category of those products has for each of the attack vectors, with 1 being very low risk, ranging all the way up to 5, which is medium to high risk. So, you know, I'm not going to reveal individuals what their you know, results were, but I'll summarize the results. Most people, and also I made sure that each person completing this did it independently before seeing anybody else's results, so that they weren't tainted. But then we did have discussions afterwards to understand differences.
Just at a high level, after the discussions, did most of scores converge, or were there still sort of substantial disagreements after kind of the discussions?
There was convergence. Like with, I think, 3 conversations I had with people, I moved in each of those 3 conversations, I moved like two of my answers by like a point. And I think correspondingly they did as well, and generally wound up converged. So for the most part, I'd say that it was like fairly good convergence. There's a couple outliers. I think Max is okay with me outing him because we're going to talk about it on the show here.
Yeah, and I'm fine to explain all my thinking behind why as well.
So Max rates, or let me start by just saying what the majority thought. The majority thought that exchanges and hardware wallet were the 2 riskiest categories. The least risky was hardware wallet plus 100 hours, so people who put in the time. And then not far behind hardware wallet plus 100 hours was BitKey. But BitKey was in between hardware wallet plus 100 hours and the other 2, exchange and hardware wallet. Most people felt that way. Max trusts certain exchanges more. And so we'll dive into that in a little bit, because I think it's a really interesting discussion. And then, like, one of the people that completed it was just overall felt like all the categories were, I mean, he rated all the categories more risky than almost anyone else, which, I mean, it's hard to argue, you know, it's hard to argue with. But another thing that was definitely consistent across everyone, if you click on the other sheet in the spreadsheet, David, for rep.
Yeah.
We also asked people to, for 4 different types of users, it's still showing the first sheet.
Okay. Here we go.
There we go. So 4 different types of users, basically either they have a lot of Bitcoin, or either, you know, little to, you know, basically like a ton, or, you know, not a ton. And then also, are they willing to put in the time to study and be diligent or not? And then for each of those types of users, what would be the recommended product mix? And I think mix is the key word here.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's easy for people to fall into a trap of, like, when you're comparing Coinbase versus Ledger versus Trezor versus BitKey versus these different products or whatever, that you have to pick one, or, you know, you can only recommend one and a person can only use one. And that's certainly not the case. A very strong case can be made that whatever solution you pick, you should diversify your custody strategy. And if you pick 2, I think a credible argument could be made picking 2 that are in distinct buckets whatever you choose, that's safer than any one that you choose. Even the hardware wallet plus 100 hours, the people have put in the work mm-hmm. and have a really strong security solution. You could argue that you're safer if you diversify. And I think the basis for that argument is that if you look at the different categories of solutions, their risk profiles differ. Like the types of risks you might face storing your Bitcoin at River, for example, is pretty different from if it's a do-it-yourself solution where you study a lot. Very different risk profiles, but everyone completing the survey and anyone who knows anything about custody must agree that any solution has risks. So I guess that's another point I'd make, is that when looking at any one particular solution, it's easy to, one can point out and identify many risks, you know, and you can compare it against perfection, but there's no product available that's perfect. So when you go to make actual decision, you do have to look at the risks, the pros and cons of each of these solutions, compare them, and then choose. And a choice available to you is to split your stack across a couple solutions. Anyway, so to wrap up with that framework, in terms of the survey results, every single person did recommend a mix. And BitKey was in that mix for every single person, including the people that were most concerned and critical of BitKey. So I found that interesting. I mean, it doesn't surprise me. That's my answer. And actually, it was part one. It was some of the genesis for this survey, because some of the people I was debating on BitKey, they'd identify risks, and those are legitimate risks that they identify, and we can talk about it on the show. I'm not trying to hide anything. I'm more diligent than most people on like identifying these risks. But at the same time, you have to be honest with other products too. And in particular, when you think about friends and family that you'd recommend to, most are not going to put the 100 hours in. And so if you're comparing BitKey versus using a cold card or Trezor Ledger out of the box as instructed, or an exchange, all of a sudden your concerns of BitKey, now you're comparing against concerns of these other categories as well. And I just want like a good faith debate and a good faith evaluation so that people are making the best choices.
And I noticed there's a question came out on chat. Where does a multi-device, multi-sig rank? So is it, do you think that people, when they saw a hardware wallet plus 100 hours, were they assuming single sig hardware wallet or just any configuration of any sets of hardware wallet?
I think, I didn't explicitly ask everyone that completed this, but in my mind and what I think people who completed this were thinking, hardware wallet, like column C, as you can see here right now, I think people were thinking single sig. And also not using a passphrase, because basically just following the directions of Ledger or Trezor or whatever product you're using. But, and then for multi-sig, I was thinking the hardware wallet plus 100 hours, that people who put in the time, do their homework, study, some will choose multi-sig and some won't. Some might choose single sig with passphrase, but that's where people who are using multi-sig would go down that route. Now, related to this, another category that doesn't really fit nicely into the survey would be like a Casa or Unchained, and probably AnchorWatch as well. So, I'd call that like a room for improvement for the future, or a future revision of the survey. Because those are important products too, and we can talk about it on today. We can talk about it right now where we think those land relative to the other options. I think that would be good. But products like Casa and Unchained, AnchorWatch don't require 100 plus hours of study. do offer some really nice safety and security benefits. All of them do. They also happen to, but they do, they, like every other solution, they have drawbacks. The most pointed one is cost. You know, we talked about AngerWatch last week. It starts at 55 basis points per year. Let's make sure I get my math right this week. But if you have $1 million of Bitcoin, you'd be paying $5,500 per year for the solution. If Bitcoin goes to where we think it might go, and you know, let's say that million turns into 10 million, then you're paying $55,000 per year for your custody solution, which is orders of magnitude more than any of the other solutions we talked about here, some of which are free. And then Casa, I haven't looked at their latest, I haven't looked at their pricing for years, but you know, it used to be like for their 3FI solution was $1,800 a year. So that, you know, relative to AngerWatch, that's nice because it's fixed fee. So if you have $1 million or $10 million, $1,800 really is kind of negligible. But still, it's much more costly than like buying a cold card, Trezor, Ledger.
Yep. And so my takeaway from at least some of the, I don't think I've seen the fully synthesized or average kind of numbers, but I think by, as I was a participant in taking the survey, one of the things that I think surprised me once I sort of got my ideas out on paper, on digital paper there, is that, you know, I think there's a strong narrative that exchanges, you know, are easy but risky, and that hardware wallets somehow fix the problems of exchanges. And once you actually go across the spectrum of these things and rate the risks, it turned out that I think the exchange and hardware wallet, without much study, without the 100 hours of study, but the hardware wallet just kind of out of the box, was sort of in line with the risk of exchanges. Not identical. Maybe you get a little bit of advantage, but it's not a massive win versus the hardware wallet with 100 hours is massive, massive win. Like really doing something, of course, it comes with more, a lot more education and work. And then BitKey was basically like on the order of simplicity of the exchange or the hardware wallet without any thinking, you know, without much thinking, kind of out of the box. But it was very close to the effectiveness or kind of the lowering the risk in the custody situation around the hardware wallet plus 100 hours. So effectively, like BitKey gets you, you know, you pay for the BitKey server or the BitKey device, but then you get roughly equivalent profile to what you might get if you did a traditional hardware wallet with 100 hours.
Yeah, why don't you go? I just shared my answers with you, David. You can go ahead
and
project those.
Okay, you shared this where on?
Signal.
Okay, on Signal, yeah.
And so these are not cumulative results. They are my results, but they are, like I said, I did modify my results after seeing other people's answers, discussing the differences.
Yep.
And they made good arguments as to why I should like increase or decrease some of these values. And so I think what everyone's seeing now is pretty representative of the 789 people that completed this. But, you know, I'd say, you know, one person in particular had harsher ratings across the board. And in particular, and I think they had BitKey rated sort of just as bad as hardware wallet and exchange. And then Max, you know, we'll talk about, I think Max's results had all three other non-exchange categories as relatively worse than exchange, being either sort of on par or favorable. I forget exactly what, but certainly relative to the rest of the group, you know, more favorable towards exchange.
And I've updated some of my thinking on that as well. So I would love to get into that as well.
Cool.
But I mean, I think it's crazy to see that exchange and hardware wallet out of the box are roughly equivalent. Like once you've sort of converged on these, like that's very different than I think the common narrative would suggest, right?
Agreed. And so this is probably going to be controversial with any hardcore Bitcoiner listening, or if like we start debating this on, you know, someone like, I mean, I'm happy to tweet out these results too to stir up some good conversation. But yeah, hardcore Bitcoiners who self-custody, certainly like, you know, MBK and people selling self-custody products, you know, MBK is probably going to throw up on this, you know, and, you know, not your keys, not your coins. Obviously, I'm in that camp too, because I think Bitcoin like fails if we don't have not your keys, not your coins. If not a sufficient number of people and amount of Bitcoin is self-custodied, the project will fail. Bitcoin will fail. I feel strongly about that.
I think there's something extremely important to add there, which is, and I've had this conversation with like CEOs of a bunch of major companies that I know, you know, in private, the vast majority of people they work with actually don't feel that way. And I think it's super, super important to remember that the way that we are framing this is off of Bitcoin Twitter, super hardcore Bitcoin people, people that are on Nostr. The vast majority of Bitcoiners have no idea what's going on in Bitcoin Twitter. And I would just couch all of that by saying, like, we are in a very, very small segment of them. I agree. It's extremely important always that the right for self-custody is defended. It's extremely important that these, you know, the hardcore Bitcoiners exist and that, you know, there's as much diversity and exchange optionality as possible. But I just think, DK, to your point that most Bitcoiners don't feel or feel this way, I think that's definitely wrong. I mean, the empirical data is most Bitcoiners leave their coins on exchanges. Now, maybe some of that's really, really, really dumb and some of those exchanges are horrible, but I think the not your keys, not your coins is a tiny segment of actual Bitcoiners, just to be clear.
Yeah. So I agree. I agree with everything you said. So my own opinion, Bitcoin will fail as a project if a sufficient number of people number of people and a sufficient number of coins are not self-custody. And I don't know what the threshold is. I don't think anyone does. But you know, it's not close to zero, but it's also not close to 100%. I'll just throw out some numbers. This is just like total wild ass guess. But let's say, like, you know, I'd feel pretty comfortable if more than 50% of the coins are self-custodied and tens of millions of people self-custody globally. Like, I feel like that's a pretty good foundation. Obviously, either of those numbers bigger, you know, larger, then we're even stronger. So I feel super strongly that that is required for long-term success of Bitcoin. I think anyone who deeply understands Bitcoin knows that. That's not inconsistent with what you just said, Max, which is like the majority of Bitcoiners not having spent the time to think about that or not having deep enough knowledge about Bitcoin to really understand that. And then also you can both hold that view and at the same time still say that self-custodying Bitcoin is, you know, has safety concerns today. And according to the numbers I'm showing, which are my own assessment, that using a hardware wallet out of the box is no more or less safe than a third-party exchange. That those aren't inconsistent with each other. The good news is each and every year, self-custody solutions improve. So these numbers will change over time. In fact, if we would have done this, you know, if I was asked to fill this out based on, you know, 2015 tech or something, there'd be much greater risk with, you know, the hardware wallet category, the big key category wouldn't even exist. So the good news is each and every year, I expect, both exchanges and hardware wallets to improve. Like we talked about a few weeks ago, we talked about River adding proof of reserves. That's an example of an exchange improving, you know, their safety. So any of these categories can improve.
Yeah, I want to just highlight a comment in the chat from Leroy Jenks. There's a question that says, why is it the same? Hardware wallet is safe from a hack if you keep your private keys secure, no? And I think that was commenting on the fact that the exchange, the hardware wallet, in this case, in Steve's estimate or assessment, these are each score an 18. So basically, like, a hardware wallet is just as risky as, you know, kind of keeping your coins in exchange. You know, different risks, but you know, ultimately it sums up to a similar risk profile. And you know, I was just going to point out things like a couple of weeks ago, Steve, you shared some commentary about a friend of yours who I think had. Was it Ledger with the Ledger suite, is it? Or the transaction coordinator?
It was Trezor.
Okay, Trezor with Trezor.
So this was maybe like 4 years ago. This person, it was a childhood friend of mine. He was doing so many things right. He bought Bitcoin. He was a hodler. He wasn't day trading, wasn't dealing with shit coins. He self-custodied. He bought a Trezor. He was increasing his stack over time. And one particular day, he bought more Bitcoin on Coinbase and he wanted to transfer it to his Trezor. So everything I'd said, like, amazing, great job. You know, and I hadn't even, he did all his own research and figured that out himself. So very proud of him. Sadly, he lost all of Bitcoin. And what happened? He used Trezor, you know, out of the box. And Trezor out of the box at the time, the wallet was, the software wallet was Trezor, like web wallet. They didn't have a desktop app, which I think they have Trezor Suite now, which is a desktop app. So as a web wallet, and he was at lunchtime, he wanted to transfer his Bitcoin from Coinbase to his Trezor. So he just Googled Trezor, you know, web wallet or Trezor wallet or something like that, clicked in the first link. You know, we've been using Google for 20 or 25 years. Of course, Google is like trusted. Click on the first link, of course. Sadly, Google has a policy of not allowing a company like Trezor to advertise because they're a crypto company, but somehow allows criminals to advertise. So they allowed a criminal to advertise. And the first link was, of course, this criminal's website, which if you click on it, it looks exactly like Trezor wallet. So my friend, you know, plugged in his Trezor wallet into his computer, and then the website, which again he believed was Trezor wallet, said, "Oh, your hardware is malfunctioning. Let us help you recover. Type in your seed phrase here to help us recover." And of course, people listening are like, "Well, that was idiotic to type in your seed phrase," and that's exactly what he did. But you know, he's a normal human being. You don't have to be like low IQ or a total idiot to fall for this. He was at lunchtime. He's kind of under time pressure. Everything was set up to feel trusted. He used Google. It looked like Trezor. Everything felt like the experience he was used to. He told me as soon as he typed in the words and hit return, right when he hit return, he felt that gut punch. So he kind of knew deep down it was dumb. And obviously it was, because he instantly lost his money. And for him, I think it was like to the tune of 4 Bitcoin, and it was like his life savings. So it was like an extremely meaningful amount of money to him. Anyway, the point is he's sort of doing everything right. If people listening think he's just an idiot, no one else, they're not going to do that, or no one else is going to do that, I completely disagree. I think lots of people would fall for something like this. And I would say that phishing attacks and these types of social engineering attacks are only improving over time. And I know that's something Max is going to talk about in a few minutes. So that just more and more of us are going to fall for these types of attacks. So if you expose customers to direct sensitive material, like the private keys in whatever form, even English words, it's a foot gun in waiting.
I think the other one I would highlight on the hardware wallet, you know, is you've got it ranked as a 4, but malware. So like you mentioned the example of how effectively phishing or phishing-like attack caused your friend to get compromised. I think the malware one is another very, very easy one to fall for, which is like you're using your Mac or your PC and it's your daily driver. And, you know, you need, you know, some PDF writer or some random utility that you just download. And even if the developer of that thing is not malicious, they may have accidentally left a backdoor or pulled in a library or somebody else's third-party software that is malicious. And then that can either do address replacement while you're trying to send something or otherwise get you to input 12 words and they compromise your wallet. So I think the hardware wallet has a lot of points of risk when you just use it with kind of off-the-shelf things. And unless you really spend the time and get very custom about how you do it with open source software that you're like, you know, doing your own kind of checksums on, and, you know, it gets a much more complicated process. You know, so I think it's, you know, hardware wallet kind of out of the box has a false sense of security and certainty. And you can see in the chat, even, you know, there's the concept of the physical attack and how you can, you can have your passphrase and your seed words, your private key can be extracted from your stolen device. So there's just stuff like that that you're still exposed to until you really, really understand this. And I worry too about things like, you know, I think BitKey, you know, actually has a pretty good rating here, but I still worry about the fact, like we were talking about the reproducible builds, and how do I know that the BitKey software that I have is the actual software that was shipped to me, you know, even if it's not a malicious actor. Pieces that you have, the more layers that you can't verify, the more risk that you open yourself up to.
Yeah. Now, I'd like to maybe just jump in and give a little bit of my thoughts on this, because I think your example of the friend who lost his life savings is kind of like, to me, that's the emblematic example. And I want to just come back to this point that Bitcoin Twitter is a very small segment of people, and like, God bless all in there. And like, for anyone that wants to self-custody, I am so in support always. I think it's critical. It has to exist, the right to self-custody. But, you know, I've had many people, you know, ask me recently, that are somewhat new to the game and maybe haven't put in the 100 hours, are willing to do 10 hours or 20 hours of research. What should I do? And in good faith, as I see the internet changing all around us quickly, you know, I can tell them there's two major categories of risk, but in good faith, I can't tell most people like to self-custody. I think at this stage in the game, with the caveat, it depends on where you live and what country you live in, right? So I would like to maybe just start by saying I used to be hardcore in the self-custody camp. So it's not like I don't get this. Like I was in the camp of like, oh my God, not your keys, not your coin, all the way out there. And over time, I've moderated that view substantially. The numbers that I came up with here, just to give you an idea, and I've changed this even a little bit since we last spoke, Steve, is 15 for exchange, 27 for hardware wallet, 19 for hardware wallet plus 100 hours, and 17 for BitKey, with the caveat that BitKey I'm sort of still learning about. And so in that world, you know, for me, I do view in the exchange category of risk, I think it really matters what exchange you're using first and foremost. And so if, again, I think it's a very complex decision tree. The first question is where you live in the world. If you live in the United States, then I think there are some extremely good options. If you live in the United States, to be clear, there's three exchanges I would consider using, and each of them have their own set of trade-offs, but I think it's very important to understand those. River, Block, Coinbase. Of those three, I still can't even recommend Coinbase, because as we've discussed, I think Coinbase is becoming, and also in agreement with what you were saying earlier, way too much of a honeypot. They custody way too much Bitcoin. I do think Coinbase is going to get hacked at some point. That's one of my sort of out there predictions, probably not this year, but probably in the next 4 years. And also because they're supporting way too many shit coins. I don't trust that their security and the bounty size of them is good enough. So I probably wouldn't recommend Coinbase. I think it's the best of the rest. So that leaves us with two options, River and Block. Both of those companies, personally, I feel like the vast majority of users in the United States, if you weigh all the different risks, are much more likely in 10 years to have some outcome that will change their life in a meaningful way if their money is in River or Block than if they self-custody, full stop. And the reason for that is, number one, in the case of River, both of those two companies have pros and cons. Case of River, the biggest con against them is they are startups. That means they don't have a ton of cash necessarily to make you whole if something goes wrong. There's always the chance that something can go wrong. But this is the one company that has consistently, for years and years and years, obviously, disclaimer, I'm an investor, I really believe in them. But Alex has, over time, repeatedly, by being the CEO and the CTO, made all the best decisions for 5+ years in a row around optimizing what they support and how they support it. There are no shitcoins. It means all of their security is fully tailored towards Bitcoin. Every new feature they roll out makes the custody safer and safer with River. For example, you now have, in addition to the proof of reserves you discussed, just I think 3 days ago, they announced Force Field, which is genius. Once again, Alex just continues to fucking kill it. Mark my words.
Yeah, really well done.
He's going to be the best founder in the space in 10 years. I fundamentally believe that. River is going to be, I think, bigger and better than Coinbase. I fundamentally believe that too. You know, Force Field, basically, if you want to withdraw, it takes 5 days to deactivate. So even if something horrible happens and whatever, you're always going to have lots of time to check and make sure, you know, are my savings with River okay? You know, they're holding it themselves, distributed storage with extreme precautions. And so anyway, so I think for most people, River is an absolutely incredible option. And I think the chances of them having a life-changing event, holding their money with River, are much higher in 10 years than holding it themselves. Second company is Block. I know we're biased here, but I think Block, you know, is the only public company in the world that's Bitcoin only, that has the best talent in the world. I definitely trust storage with Cash App, as we've joked about. And I know I've heard rumblings this may change. Even if you want to take your Bitcoin off of Cash App, you can't. So that's a good security measure. So, you know, over time, I hope that changes. But in the meantime, I kind of love it. I think it's awesome. And I also fundamentally believe Block is a company with enough cash. If something really horrible happened, I fundamentally believe Jack, like Alex, is in this for the right reasons. They would find a way to make people whole. And so those two companies are different than all the rest. All the other exchanges besides those three that I mentioned, I would absolutely not trust. If I'm in another country, I would not trust.
Wait a minute now. Leroy Jenks has a question. He says, sure. Not Strike?
You know, actually, that's a fair point. I also like Strike a lot, and I am a small investor there as well. I don't know enough about their solutions to say yes or no, to be frank, on the custody side.
You now are not just shilling your book, you're right.
No, I'm not shilling my book. I'm being fundamentally honest. Like I'm saying, what would I recommend to an absolute best friend? I believe in 10 years, Leishman, I fundamentally believe he's made the right choice. I'm not saying that the other Jack hasn't. Like, maybe it's absolutely amazing as well. I know they've raised a lot of money. They have great talent. I just personally can't speak to their setup. I can for Rivers.
So a few comments on that. A big risk with any third party is that even if one's assessment is fully accurate today, in 5 years, it can be totally different because CEOs change, management changes, the individual contributors in the team change. So the brilliant engineers who created an amazing architecture in 5 years are all gone, and the people they replace them with, they don't care as much, they don't have as much passion, they don't have as much knowledge. Any of these third parties, it's not just good or bad software, or whether or not you trust the CEO, but it's the processes involved as well. And processes can develop weaknesses and gaps and holes over time as people churn. And all what was once secure, all of a sudden can get exposed. And a rogue employee or an external hacker can determine those weaknesses over time. So I think that's really important to bear in mind. And that's why I would, even though I agree with the sentiment you're saying, Max, and I, even in my own ratings, I'm saying a hardware wallet, self-custody out of the box is equivalent safety as an exchange, which again, I think a lot of hardcore Bitcoiners will throw up on. I wouldn't say that third parties are much safer than a hardware wallet, like your ratings show. You also made an important point, which is, we're lumping all third parties into one category, and there's a huge range.
Yeah.
So I'm also an investor and friends and close with Alex, so biased, but like I agree with all your comments on Alex and River. So I put River up there strong, with a strong ranking relative to third parties. But that again, that said, if they do have a tragic event, they're not going to, the company, Alex himself, I mean, they're not going to be able, like, refund people.
Totally.
And even, so you didn't say on the show, but like in the case of Block, it's like, well, Jack loves Bitcoin and like he could make people whole. Well, not if Cash App's the recommended solution, everyone, trillions of dollars of Bitcoin are put at Block because it's the safe solution and you got Jack involved. Well, no single person or company has trillions of dollars and also to buy all the Bitcoin, obviously it's going to cost even more than that. So I don't think that's like a super credible argument either. It's also a weird, like Coinbase, a risk with Coinbase is that they are such a huge honeypot. So
yes,
even though I do believe Coinbase has strong security and practices and processes, like I wouldn't trust them. They're certainly not idiots. They created good processes, but they are subject to everything I said earlier. CEOs, management, and individual contributors can change. Certainly individual contributors absolutely have changed over time at any of these companies, and processes can get leaky. Something we've mentioned in a past show too with Coinbase is that since they support many different coins, they make concessions. So their engineering solutions, they use like a least common denominator type solution, which makes sense from an engineering efficiency standpoint. They create a solution that works for all the different blockchains and coins. But if you only hold Bitcoin and care about your Bitcoin security, that's an inferior solution relative to one that is native to Bitcoin. And then at the end of the day, they're the biggest honeypot. So the most effort and money and attention by criminals will be placed on them because they have like 2 million Bitcoin and growing, right? And if we talk about their lending product in a little bit, that's going to attract even more Bitcoin to their solutions.
And not to mention your point on the management, you don't even have to wait for a management change. Like Brian Armstrong, like I don't remember when was the last time he was a friend of Bitcoin, right? Like Leishman has done every single, as in just one example, Jack Dorsey as well, every single decision point, it's how do we make our customers more secure for their Bitcoin? How do we add the absolute latest in, features for their Bitcoin instead of, hey, how do we create a new, whatever AWS blockchain to get grandma to buy, you know, shitcoin 4206969. So I personally get it, and they do have great engineers, blah, blah, blah. But I want to be clear on this. There's two other really critical points in there. Point number one is I'm also not so naive to think there isn't a bunch of risk, even with the Cash App and the River case, right? So I want to be very clear on what I see the risks there are, and then just how that trades off with custody changing over the next 2 years. In the case of those companies, even if I think they have the best security, even if I think they have the best CEOs, and I do, one risk, which I want to be very clear, I rated a 5 on your survey, is nationalization. But to your point, you brought up DK, I almost assume with like a close to 100% certainty that the big Bitcoin honeypots will get nationalized. Like the US government will do it. I don't know when it's going to happen, but I have a very strong suspicion that's going to happen. In that world, to be clear, I think what ends up happening is it's not the worst of all scenarios for individual holders. And that's why I was very careful to say life-changing outcome for the individual, because I think you'll get made whole in USD. And I get it. That's shitty. That's terrible. And there's precedent for the US taking your gold, offering you dollars. And so in that case, you know, if River or Block or Coinbase or any of these companies get nationalized, then, you know, you lose your coins. Now, you still get enough that your family's not, you're not in the situation that your friend was in where you're just like, you're shit out of luck. Like your life savings are gone. So that's better than that situation. But like, I do think that's going to happen, which to be clear is why I would never recommend anyone keep all of their stuff on an exchange. I think it's a mix, right? So maybe it's mix is 50-50 self-custody, which may include BitKey now. 50% exchange, maybe it's 70% exchange, 30% self-custody. So the self-custody for me is largely there for that nationalization and or long tail hack risk. I think that's super important, and I want to clarify that.
What's interesting, so all three of us, everyone else that completed this survey, all independently concluded a mix, like custody diversification makes sense for almost everyone, whether you're a whale, whether you're new, whatever. I find that interesting because that's not the narrative. That the narrative from hardcore Bitcoiners is not your keys, not your coin. The narrative from most other people is like, just don't, you know, just use Coinbase or right. River or whatever. And I don't hear anyone saying like diversify custody solutions. And that I think should be the narrative. I understand why not your keys, not your coins is the Bitcoiner narrative, because most people don't. So you got to scream and yell that to shake people up. So I get that. But the truth of the matter is that what people really should do is split it between both. And then depending on your own personal situation, I want to ask a number of questions, whether I'd recommend like 10% to self-custody or 50% or 90%. It depends on a lot of factors, but almost certainly for everyone, it's a mix. Another important point I wanted to make is I think, especially hardcore Bitcoiners, I mean, there's just tons of different attack vectors where you can lose your coins. And I think a common mistake people can make is really overemphasizing a couple and then not really thinking about others. So like the nationalization of Bitcoin, I absolutely think that could happen. I mean, it needs to be on the table. And most people think that's crazy, probably. I don't think it's crazy. But I do think it's much lower probability right now than like a North Korean remote attack, like a phishing scam, or a person losing their backup, or a person storing their seed phrase in LastPass.
Mm, yeah.
And then losing. And guess what? LastPass was hacked a couple of years ago. And guess what? The hacker stole a bunch of wallets because people stored their seed phrase in there.
Exactly.
That something like that is high probability to happen. Or people who take a photo of their seed phrase and upload it to the cloud and have their coin stolen. Or the you know, personal example I gave from a friend who fell for a phishing attack. I think the probability of user foot gun losing or accidentally revealing their keys is much higher probability than nuclear attacks, like earthquakes destroying your Bitcoin. Although we did just have the LA fires, which I still haven't heard concrete examples, but it wouldn't surprise me if some people lost all their Bitcoin through that. And then in government attacks. So in my mind, like user error is the biggest risk today. And then like remote attacks is next. And then way down, like much further from that, would be like $5 wrench attack, home invasion, government banning Bitcoin or stealing it from people. And so when assessing your own solutions, I think it's really important to bear all that in mind as well, and not to get too freaked out on one particular attack that's like a one in a million chance or something.
Yeah.
And neglecting to consider the far more likely way that you're going to lose your Bitcoin.
And I want to be clear on that. So there's two things I've changed since we've even talked about in the survey. One is on the hardware wallet side. And I think this is actually something that I went a little outside the lines for coloring here. I upgraded my risk for backup loss on the hardware wallet to a 7 instead of 5. Like, I don't think it should be like, I don't think 5 should be the max. Like if I think about how are most people going to lose this ship, one is they're just going to lose it because they're humans and they lose stuff and we're humans. And so I think that is like, if you look at how people have actually lost their coins, it's either because they actually lost their stuff, they got phished, or they were on an exchange that frankly, they have no business being on, like a Malgox or an FTX or some crap exchange. So if you take the crap exchange out, you know, like again, I'm very specific with my exchange solution. On those two though, I think, the risk of losing the key should be way higher, including for the 100 hours plus. Part of my, you know, sort of thesis here is that humans, no matter how smart you are, like humans are just like dumb is the wrong word, used a better word, but like humans are human. We're unaware. You think you've got everything figured out, but you're a human and humans have mistakes and that's normal. And so I think increasingly, you know, trusting someone to like custody their own stuff is just like that is a tall order. And I think it's much higher than a 5 that someone just makes a mistake. The second thing I would say is on the phishing stuff. And this is the area that I've been thinking a lot more about. I actually want us to do one or several more episodes just on the concurrent singularities of Bitcoin and AI. I'm increasingly convinced there's almost no one in the world that really understands what's happening in both of these fields. And I've been getting by the week increasingly more AGI, ASI pilled. I think people are absolutely asleep at the wheel on how fast all of that is happening. And so the second thing I would say is the attacks that could emerge in the next year or two from AIs, the amount of sophistication with phishing, hacking, et cetera, is about to get way higher really fast. And so I'm not saying you, again, like these are all just things to consider that you shouldn't obviously have like, you know, your own setup and all that. But like, do I trust the block team to be able to fight better against AGI than, you know, random Joe Schmo? Yeah, definitely.
But I think that goes to the point though, why you want to diversify your custody, because you don't know what kinds of problems will show up. I mean, one of the big reasons that I have diversified over the years is because Steve was an advocate of this. Like, you don't want to, you know, have one accident and then just be out of the Bitcoin experiment, right? Like the whole thing is crazy asymmetric upside if and when the thing works. And so even if you lost half your coins or 80% of your coins, but the thing still has 100x to run, like that's actually fine. You're still winning.
Yeah.
Even though you lost most of it, the majority of it, the vast majority of it, you're still winning. And if you diversify, you actually still get to be part of the experiment. And if you don't diversify, you can go from everything to nothing. The other thing, though, I know. Yeah.
One last thing I want to add on here, I think is very important. To your earlier point, though, Steve, about if people don't hold their keys, I think there's the self-interested way to look at this, and then the sort of experiment with Bitcoin itself, right? And so I've been speaking from the perspective of someone in the middle class that wants to get life-changing money and break free. And like, I stand by everything I've said for that person. Now, if I look at this from the perspective of Bitcoin itself needs to work, to your point, we don't know how many keys people need to hold their own keys outside of the system for that to work. And I'm also very open to the idea that if too many people go in this way of trusting, then the whole experiment will eventually fail. That's a very fair point. So when I put on that lens, the other question that I would raise is back to our very first episode, the original one when we were all in person, how do we make sure that there is an extreme diversity of excellent, high quality custodians, right? Like the fact that Coinbase is custodying for every ETF and MicroStrategy is insane. And the fact that it's all in the US, that's a good start, but that's also crazy, right? Like over time, I think another way to achieve that goal, in addition to like the cypherpunks, and like God bless the cypherpunks, but for the middle class that you still want to be able to help them break free, I think that in my ideal world, when we're talking about this 10 years from now, there's not two custodians I would trust, but 200. And they're split between the United States, El Salvador, Switzerland, Singapore, Germany, you know, all over the world. They're all Bitcoin only. They're all like River and Block, constantly adding security features. I think that's another way you can meet the threshold to make sure Bitcoin survives.
And protocols like Fediment are a way to achieve that as well. It's, you know, or very early stage, but that can get to that future. Just one last point that's related to that. I just want to make people aware that when it's a third party exchange or company, some of them build their own in-house solutions. Like River has done that and Block has done that. And like Fidelity has done that. So the Fidelity ETF that's using Fidelity engineering and processes to custody the Bitcoin. Whereas I think all but maybe one other ETF uses Coinbase. Someone asked about Strike and no one's brought up Swan, but like Swan's an example of they never had their own in-house solution. They use third parties and they've had problem after problem after problem. I don't know the status of what they're doing. They definitely hired a bunch of engineers. I think they brought some of this in-house. I don't know where they're at. And then I think with Strike too, historically, Strike also outsourced. And I don't know where Strike has gone since then. But also even companies that are in-house can later decide to outsource. You can get a manager in charge who sees the numbers and sees this is how much it's costing us. This isn't our core competency. Outsource it. So just because the company is doing it in-house one day doesn't mean that they don't change their mind later. Or a company builds it in-house and guess what? They don't decide to outsource, but they don't spend the resources necessary to keep it up to date and it develops cracks and then it's weaker. So there is a lot of risk with third parties as well.
One thing that'd be really nice there, to your point, vigilance is required. I mean, I say all of this from the position of someone who has been in the industry like you guys for a long time and watched all of this and like would not trust like 90% of these custodians again too. But I think it would be very interesting to your point. Like most people don't realize that they see Swan as a lot of marketing and sounds good. It's Bitcoin only. I have no idea what their custody looks like. And I think River, it's finally starting to click with people that like these guys are the best technically and like, oh my God, like that's who I should be, you know, trusting. But it wasn't like that for a long time. In the same way that there is the wallet scrutiny stuff that I know you work on and those kind of sites, it would be really interesting for someone or some group to come up with a site that's like exchange scrutiny and just like straight up is like, here are the 10 exchanges or whatever in your country, here are all the exchanges. Like, let's just go straight up like, In an open source, verifiable, easy to track way, who rolls their own custody? Like, is it split? Yeah. If it's split, where are the signers? In which countries? Do they have proof of reserves? If so, like, what is the last time we have a proof of their, whatever their reserves? Like that site would be super, super,
it's a great
super
idea.
I love that idea. I just noted it down. I'll look into it.
You should mention, do you think the wallet scrutiny team would be interested in such a thing?
I'll talk to the wallet scrutiny team. And then if maybe anyone's listening or knows of someone who might want to create such a project or do it as part of wallet scrutiny, Viral will be interested in funding that. That's a great idea. I wanted to spend a few minutes. We got some audience feedback here. I just wanted to like respond to some of it that we haven't yet. So one person says, you guys are stressing me out. Lol. I understand that. When you see how the sausage is made, it's scary. And again, all these solutions have risks and it's scary. If you don't think about it or you don't study it, you can like sleep well at night maybe, but you know, is it better to be armed with knowledge or not? I think when it comes to like protecting your Bitcoin, you want to be armed with knowledge. So maybe there's a bit of a scary phase, but you're better off understanding all this stuff. I guess the one piece of advice I'm taking away from our conversation and what I've learned the past 8+ years on custody is, if you diversify across two distinct solutions, you should be sleeping better at night. Because even though you know both solutions have risks, there's not a lot of overlap. And as David said earlier, you're much better off losing half your stack than 100% of your stack. And the reality is, there's still a very good chance you're going to lose none of your stack. So even though we're highlighting risks and concerns, it's not like we're saying that everyone's going to lose all their Bitcoin no matter what. That would definitely be scary. But
I also think it's easy to get stressed out when you hear us talking about this because we're trying to digest a bunch of different trade-offs and a very serious issue. And, you know, a lot of Bitcoiners are very serious about it, which is a good way to be because this is real money. But I think there's another perspective I never hear anybody talk about, which I guess I think Steve has encouraged me on this a long time ago. And I think I've really taken it to heart, which is like when you maybe start however you're able to start, whatever you want to start is fine. Just get started. Learn. Don't even buy, but just learn if you need to get started. But as you progress on your journey, when you make the move into like your first self-custody solution, you can be clicking through like the hardware wallet software or trying to get Electrum set up and you're worried like, am I doing it right? Did I generate the thing right? And instead, treat it like it's fun. Treat it like a hack project. Assume you're going to put almost nothing of value into it and just get comfortable playing with the stuff. Like generate some keys. Huh, what does that do? Oh, that generates a bunch of addresses. Oh, weird. Okay, I guess I get how those pieces fit together. And it's such a, just lower the stakes. Don't make it about your whole stack or your personal wealth or your family generational wealth. Just make it about fun. Make it a hack project. I want to see if I can get Tails OS installed or, you know, Electrum installed. I want to see what it's like to generate keys. And should I pick 12 or 24? Like, well, I don't know. Like, let me read about that or learn about that. Every step of the way, you can just lower the stakes and just get experience with it and commit to yourself that this is not my final solution. I'm not actually setting it up. All I'm doing is playing. I'm playing and getting comfortable with the tools and learning. And once you take that perspective, it just gets you get to lower the stakes and you just get comfortable with it. And then it's very easy to de-stress on this. And then only once you're like, actually, I get every piece of this. I understand the sequence. I understand what I'm doing, you know, GPT verified, different software, whatever, if you need to, you know, but I've done all the pieces. Now I'm comfortable. Now it's easy. Now I can easily diversify into this thing because I just have so much experience with it. But that's kind of the 100 hours, right? That's where that comes from. That comes from like starting with a beginner's mind of I'm not trying to set up a very serious thing. I'm trying to play and get experience with it.
I think that's awesome. Awesome advice. And let's double down on that because we've been saying that, 100 hours and not a lot of people are going to do it, but we should absolutely encourage people to do it. And I think the way you just framed it, it's really good mental model to make it sound less intimidating and daunting. And, ideally more and more and more people go down that path. I mean, ideally everyone does. And there's definitely a train of thought that eventually everyone will, in that because Bitcoin goes from this like fascination, do you buy a little, to all of a sudden you go down this journey. And now it's like the majority of my wealth and I don't want to lose it. I really care about it. And I also am aware of all these risks. And then you do put the time in. And I think that's a really good mental model.
And I would add two things on that. One, I agree. That's great advice, not only for this, but just for life in general. Like at the end of the day, also, I think it's important to remember like, yeah, money's important, but it's still just a tool. One thing that I personally don't love about being all in on Bitcoin, and frankly, one of the reasons I'm much more excited right now about things like Nostr and Stacker News, is because I think that, even though Bitcoin's awesome, like, I think worshiping money in any way, shape, or form all the time, obsessing about it, protecting it, getting the guns, or like, look, at the end of the day, like, you do your best and then things happen. And like, yes, it would be shitty to lose stuff. But at the same time, if you're not having fun and it becomes a weird obsession, like that's not healthy either. And I do think a lot of the Bitcoin community ends up going in that direction. So one rec there is for people that are new in all of this, that are just playing with all of this and having fun, as DK said, would be start on something like Stacker News, download maybe Primal, play with Nostr, get some zaps. Or lately, I've been actually just yesterday was playing just for fun with Rizful, which came from the guys from the Megalith node. That's awesome. LB also has a way to do this, but just like ways to set up your own Lightning node, start sending payments, get your own Nostr keys. Like I felt playing with Rizful yesterday was the most fun I've had with Bitcoin in a long time because I was just like setting new stuff up, super low stakes. It cost me 25 cents and it was great. So I'd recommend everyone maybe before you start worrying about your lifelong custody solution or even custodying the Bitcoin, maybe just start playing with the payment stuff and just having fun because it's cool. It's like genuinely cool. Second thing I would say is one extremely important caveat I want to re-stress, and Steve, you hit me with this last time and I mentioned it, but I think it's super important for listeners. I realize everything that I've been saying on this podcast is extremely US centric. And so I want to re-stress that's true. Everything I'm saying, all of my recommendations are for a middle-class person trying to break free in the United States. If you are not in the United States and you're living in, you're one of like, you know, the vast majority of the world that's not, I take everything I say back. And probably shouldn't trust your exchange. Maybe still a little bit on there, And I've invested in a lot of exchanges, you know, that are international. And so some of those, you know, I would increasingly recommend over time, but they're still startups. And so you want to wait until they kind of reach enough of a breakout velocity, have, you know, enough of a balance sheet and enough of a staff. Like over time, that will change. And there are, you know, Bitcoin only ones, you know, companies like Pouch, like Beepa, like, you know, Osmo, Yopakli, all of these companies. And that's great. Bitnob, you know, I'm an investor in and supportive of all, but like, you know, they're going to keep maturing and over time you'll get more comfortable. So for those people, I think this is frankly where something like BitKey is much more interesting to me. I think the hardware wallet and doing your own research, that's great. And that should be a part of it. But I think something like collaborative custody or not collaborate. Yeah. Something like BitKey, where if you're a normal person, you don't have to store a seed phrase, but you can like have your thumbprint. You can share and have recovery, social recovery with your family members or your best friends. Yep. I think that is awesome. And something like BitKey is just going to be massive in the emerging world.
Another one I want to reference related to that is I actually got a DM from somebody who I believe he was located in the Middle East, and he said that he could not get a hardware wallet shipped into the country. So I'd recommended, oh, just go for a BitKey, that we can't get those shipped into the country. And then I said, well, what about just some other hardware wallet? He's like, no, the only way to get something in is you have to have it hand delivered by somebody, not in like a shipping situation. So then I suggested, well, actually it might be worth learning about another thing, which we actually didn't talk about. It's not on the list of options, but you can, you know, hardware wallets are great and they're convenient and I've used them. I think they're effective, but you can just buy off the shelf, like USB sticks and use software that's fully open source and auditable and verifiable. And you can self custody even without a hardware wallet. Now, I'm not suggesting everybody go run after this, but if you are in a location, maybe outside the US, where you can't get a BitKey ship, you can't get a cold card or a Trezor or whatever you want to, you know, order shipped, you actually can get a USB stick and nobody's going to stop that, right? And you can learn how to do self-custody with just off-the-shelf components. And it's a whole different set of, you know, understanding and risks and trade-offs. You want to understand the whole thing, like maybe it takes a little bit more study to make sure you're doing it right. But it's actually a very, very viable option. It's probably, you know, if you get good at that, it's probably better than everything else we've talked about. Takes a lot of work to get good at it. But if you spend the time and get good at it, probably better than everything else, because there's no, you know, no supply chain attacks on your USB stick, right? It's just off the shelf hardware. So
well, before we wrap this up and move on, I just wanted to address one more question by the audience. Would you recommend more than one collaborative custody provider? I am interpreting that question to mean like we've been saying, diversify your solutions, choose, you know, two or at least two. If that question means like, you know, would we recommend you choose like Casa and Unchained or BitKey and Unchained? I think that's fine. But in general, I think picking, there's all sort of the same categories, so somewhat similar risk profile. So I think it's best to pick each of your two choices come from a different bucket. So like a BitKey or Casa as one, and then like a cold card as another, or River and Casa would be like another, you know, from two different buckets. That would be my answer. What do you guys think? Do you agree?
Yeah. I would want to diversify the style of custody instead of just the provider, but similar style. So pick a few different architectures or kind of approaches to it.
Yeah. And I would say maybe even as you get more sophisticated, I like all three buckets. Like I think everyone should have, assuming you're in the US, a Bitcoin only exchange that you trust, maybe in other countries as well, because you know there's at least some professionals guarding that for you. I think some just like straight up you have the seed phrase, you know, properly distributed probably makes sense too. And then I do think collaborative custody, I will say over, you know, historically I've been a little bit more skeptical of this, you know, I like certainly the Unchained and Casa approaches, but I think that there's more. It's more complex than the other two, which is for most people. I think the other two are just like you straight up understand the trade-offs versus not. However, I will say just playing a little bit. So with the caveat that I'm not an expert with the BitKey, that experience to me has been so much easier than anything else in the collaborative custody. I think it's almost in its own category now. But I think ideally, you know, maybe you get to a point where you have each of those categories.
Yep.
David, cool. Should we transition?
Yeah. So anything you want to summarize to finalize this? Because I think we've talked for an hour 15 on this already. I mean, I think
I worry we'll spend another hour if we try to summarize it. But the one thing we said consistently is that to diversify your custody solutions, pick two. You're safer that way.
And make sure one of them is Mt. Gox.
That's a great way to end it, Max. Most people probably have never heard of Mt. Gox. It's very inside baseball. Okay, let's bounce over to Coinbase Lending. So unfortunately, we only have now 12 minutes left because we had so much enthusiasm for that last topic. But that's fine. This Coinbase Lending product. So we've talked about lending before here on the show. And I think a lot of people misunderstand collateralized lending. So the idea of being able to use an asset that you hold and borrow against that as collateral so that the lender can claim that collateral if you don't pay back the loan. Like it's a well understood, well explored topic that is available in TradFi all over the place. Everybody in TradFi uses it. I mean, you know, there's a lot of this in TradFi. Actually, I heard the other day somebody said, hey, do you know that like billionaires use this tax avoidance scheme? I was like, that's not just billionaires. There's a lot of people who use collateralized lending. It's a great tool to help you legally avoid having to pay tax on assets that have appreciated while still getting liquidity, meaning dollars that you can use to cover your daily expenses or to buy other assets that you want. So the idea of collateralized lending is a big one. It's a big market. There's a lot of fees involved. And we've talked about Lava as a protocol and an application that can help with that. This week, Coinbase, which is obviously the 800-pound gorilla in the kind of custodian space, announced a lending product. And so we want to talk about kind of what did Coinbase announce and sort of what are the concerns or trade-offs and kind of how will this fit into the marketplace of other options around lending. So what was announced? So Coinbase now lets you borrow USDC by using your Bitcoin as collateral without selling it. You can borrow up to $100,000, but it's not available in New York. So this is only for people outside of New York, you know, in the US, outside of New York. The interest rates float, I guess, currently around 10%. I've seen numbers that look a little bit lower, maybe 7.5% or 7.6. I've seen thrown around, but it's not a fixed repayment schedule. You can pay back whenever you want. And this isn't Coinbase lending you money directly, but they're using a blockchain tech company called Morpho to make it happen. And presumably there are third-party lenders on the other side of Morpho. I don't know that for sure, but my guess is I know it's not Coinbase's money. I think it's through Morpho, and then Morpho is probably got a bunch of lenders on the other side. Critics are buzzing about the high interest rates, comparing it to a reverse mortgage. And there's talk about practical limits, like the borrowing cap and the need for KYC to participate in the Coinbase thing. Now, on the side, we had this guy named Porto, who was kind of a vocal critic of this approach. And he said some of the obvious ones is custodial, it's KYC, AML, DeFi smart contract risks. You have in addition to Coinbase being the custodian, and that's a third party that holds your Bitcoin in custody. They then have it in a DeFi smart contract, which itself is a third party type of custodian risk that could blow up or have problems. And then the 100K limit is a problem. He claimed expensive rates. I don't know if it's expensive or not. You know, and it's obviously fluctuating. And there's this question around tax. Does it require wrapping the Bitcoin as CBBTC, which is some sort of like a wrapped Bitcoin product? Is that actually something that, is that a problem? Is there a tax implication in the wrapping process? That's actually one of the biggest questions that I don't really understand. I feel like there's been a lot of FUD in both directions. I don't really understand that. So I don't know if, like, for me, that's an interesting starting point. Is you guys understand what are sort of the trade-offs, especially around kind of tax situation with the Coinbase lending product?
One thing I'd like to get straight from the jump on this is I haven't looked into this super deeply. To be clear, make this super simple. I give Coinbase one Bitcoin. Coinbase gives me a 10% yield on that. Is that clear?
No. It's a collateralized lending. So your Bitcoin is collateral, and then you can borrow maybe, $70,000 in USDC.
Got it. Okay.
Something. So, I don't know what the loan to value ratios are. But.
So my first question on all of that then, regardless if this is just traditional Bitcoin collateralized lending, is can I see exactly what they're doing with my Bitcoin? If I can't see exactly what they're doing with my Bitcoin, it sounds like from your description, there's a lot of questions around this blockchain lending, you know, piece. We don't know exactly who the counterparties are on this, and they're giving us a really high yield. My first thought is run. I mean, like, what could possibly go wrong when you're giving up the custody of your Bitcoin they're putting it into a black box and promising you a high yield BlockFi. Now, critics would say, obviously, Coinbase has way better custody. It's a public company. They have all of this money. The thing that I start thinking about then is, and I guess this word comes down to trust in the founder, which I have, you know, very little on, is that going to get commingled with all of the coins they're custodying for the ETFs and for, you know, MicroStrategy? I'm sure they'll say no, but like, can we prove that? If not, this sounds scary.
Let's see. Undoubtedly, it's commingled in general, at a minimum with everyone else who's buying CBBDC, which is their wrapped Bitcoin. Now, whether they commingle that Bitcoin with ETF Bitcoin, I would guess no, because we know for a fact, like Bitwise, which has an ETF, Bitcoin ETF that custodies with Coinbase, they have their own distinct address on the blockchain with their Bitcoin. So I'm pretty sure, like, you know, whether you're BlackRock or any of these big institutional customers, those are all compartmentalized. So I don't think it'd be commingled with that. It's also probably not commingled with just retail wallets, but I don't know.
Probably sounds scary.
Undoubtedly, it's commingled with everyone's CBBDC is commingled because it's more efficient that way. So you're taking that risk. Now, let's see, David, you asked about taxes. None of us are tax attorneys or tax experts, so obviously this is not tax advice for anyone. My interpretation, I've heard people say it could be a tax event I think undoubtedly it's a tax event if you take your Bitcoin and go to an exchange and trade it for some other coin, that incurs a tax event, at least in the United States. In every country is going to vary, but probably most countries are that way. But in the case here, I'm skeptical there'd be a tax event, because I'm guessing the way it would work is like I deposit my Bitcoin with Coinbase and I just sign up for a service from them to take out USDC loan and use my Bitcoin as collateral, and sort of their back-end machine, like, that I'm hidden from. I'm not out there trading my Bitcoin. They just happen to have this big pool of Bitcoin that gets converted to CBBTC, which is then used in a Morpho, you know, smart contract for the loan or whatever. So my guess is it's not a taxable event, but it's an open question. I mean, I'd love to hear, hopefully people listening know of legal or tax experts who are into crypto and Bitcoin and could weigh in on this. I think that's really interesting. But to me, the most, I mean, assuming if that's an issue, then it's a huge issue. Probably the number one reason people would take out a loan using their Bitcoin is to avoid selling their Bitcoin and having that tax event. So if they have to pay the tax event, they're not going to, they're probably just going to, they'll just sell a portion of their Bitcoin for dollars to spend. So that's a non-starter if it's a taxable event. Let's assume it's not a taxable event. Then I think the key things that customers will look at are, you know, number one, rate. Like, what rate do I get? And so I think that's more important than even the custody risk. So I actually thought about it myself, asked a few friends yesterday. If you have two solutions, one where there's counterparty risk or you're trusting Coinbase to hold your Bitcoin, and the other is that it's in like a smart contract where there is no counterparty risk, how much more expensive of rates would you pay for that no counterparty risk? And the conclusions from my small little sample size, including myself, is probably up to 100 basis points or 1%. So if the custodial solution was a 6% rate and the non-custodial was 7% rate, yeah, that's sort of the tipping point. And if it was like 6% versus 9% or something, I'd probably accept the custodial risk and get a much cheaper rate, because like this adds up. If you're taking out a 10-year loan for $1 million or something, that can cost you an extra $150,000 if it's, you know, 2-2.5% more interest rate. So it's real money. Yeah. I think that there has to be competitive rate. But obviously, if the rates are similar, then there's an enormous advantage to no counterparty risk. We have tons of historical evidence. We talked about Lava in the past on this show. But there's evidence with like BlockFi and Celsius and many other providers and Genesis that lost their customers their money. And a solution like Lava, it just inherently doesn't have that type of risk.
I would jump in and say, I think Personally, I think I would be in the camp of, I would be willing to take a much bigger haircut for the non-custody, just because I've seen, to your point, every single company that has done this has blown up for sure. And so to me, it's just like, if there's custody risk and I can't, and it's a black box, then I just assume I'm going to lose all of my money. So the interest rate's irrelevant to me. It's just a question of when, as every other single example we have today has. Now, the thing I'm much more interested in is, can you know, not the custody risk itself, but I'm also very curious, what are they lending it out for, too, right? Like, to me, that's much more important, is not having a black box. As an example, I'm starting to see, I think there's no question that there's a big market in Bitcoin lending, right? And I think you're starting to see other companies start to dip their toes, hint at it. I think the NYDIG has recently hinted they're going to start dipping their toes into this market, maybe building up over time. Other more traditional financial institutions, I would imagine, if, you know, laws change, will be able to play that. So to me, the big question I have is not just the custody, but the black box. That's very important to me.
Well, that's one thing I don't know the answer. I agree. And I don't know the answer to rehypothecation for Coinbase's new product. Do they come out and state they will not rehypothecate, or do their terms say that they can't? Or, you know, that would be a major factor for me.
Yeah.
Either recommending that them or using their service. If they allow for rehypothecation, that massively increases the risk, as we saw with Genesis, BlockFi, and everyone else has done this.
Everyone else.
If they have in their terms that they will not do it, their legal terms, that has a lot of teeth. And like I don't think Coinbase is going to risk their entire business by it's going to be a big barrier to them breaking their contract.
I would love to see
there be a lot more trust that they won't rehypothecate if they say in their terms they won't, and that would substantially reduce the risk with them. There's still counterparty risk. You're giving them your Bitcoin, but I think that they're. I'd love to know the answer to that.
I would love to see someone go a step further. I think there's room. I agree with you. Just giving in their terms are great, but again, that's a lot of trust for a relatively new company that's, like, we know, engaged in what I think is some pretty shady stuff. The big question that I would have is, can you have, I think, so on the one hand, there's Lava and completely non-custodial. That's beautiful. But obviously anything that's totally non-custodial is always going to be a little bit more difficult, right? So there's, anytime there's a little bit more friction, there's a segment of the market that will always, you know, go the extra mile, do that option. That's awesome. I think they're going to do very well. On the other end, you've got these guys that are going to custody for you. And I think there can be a wide variety of those players as well. One solution I would love to see is, you know, a reputable company with a major balance sheet, or a public company, maybe NYDIG is big enough privately they could do this, that, you know, you've got some, you know, default insurance if something goes wrong, not actual insurance, but like they have a massive balance sheet. And two, in addition to the term saying they're not going to rehypothecate, they can prove it. What I would love to say is, I trust you, I'm giving you my custody, but you also show me, kind of like a river with proof of reserves, how much Bitcoin comes in, how much Bitcoin goes out, and it's proven. That to me is a product I would use.
It'll be part of exchange scrutiny, Max.
Perfect. All right. Well, I know we are at the end of our time. I will just ask you, are you guys jetting over to Crypto Ball tonight?
What?
No. So they're doing an inauguration party in DC, and all the crypto companies and a bunch of the hitters are going. So I guess I'm not hanging with the hitters.
Not hanging with the hitters.
No.
I already did my jet setting this week. I'm going to have a quiet night alone.
Perfect. Where'd you go?
Oh, it's your birthday, Steve?
You can dox yourself. I would have.
Dude, happy birthday. What? Why do we not spell that?
Yeah. Well, I didn't want to dox him. I chatted to him. Happy birthday. But
I didn't know that. Happy birthday, Steve.
Thanks, man. Yeah. I already celebrated. I grew up in Iowa, went to Iowa State. Enormous Iowa State sports fan.
You guys got a good basketball team this year.
We're number two in the nation, first time ever. And
let's fucking go,
so I
baby.
Went back home on Wednesday, went to the Kansas game. We beat them by 17. It was
let's go.
Hell yeah.
I got to say, I'm also, I didn't know you were into sports. I'm a big basketball fan. Got to do it for the M, Memphis, you know what I'm saying? We got Tyrese Hunter, who used to be Iowa State star.
Yep.
Took you guys to the NCAA tournament. I love Tyrese. Shout out, Tyrese.
I didn't know you were a fan. All right. We're
good time. I'm diehard, baby.
I'm going to have to step away. I don't know anything about sports ball, but we'll have a lot to talk about next week because fireworks are happening, administration change over the weekend or on Monday, and we'll see if any executive orders show up, and we'll have that to talk about next Friday. So we will see you here. Great. Same time, same place.
Maybe Bitcoin hits 169 by then.
Could be. We'll talk about it here.
Thanks, guys.
All right. See ya.
Bye-bye.